So tonight we are still keeping in our pattern of talking about Zen chants that are important to our lineage of Zen or the Zen tradition in general. The one that we're going to talk about tonight, though, is not in the book because it is specific to our lineage, and every Zen lineage has its own specific version of it. And of course, I'm speaking about our ancestral lineage. Our ancestral lineage consisting of a name or a list of names of all of the ancestors of our particular lineage, going all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, and even a little bit before. So what I'd like to do tonight is talk about why we do this chant. Primarily, I want to focus on the reason why this is an important aspect of our shared practice. I'm going to get a little bit into individual names, but I'm actually not going to spend a whole lot of time on like the biography of Bodhidharma or something like that. We're not going to get that deep in the weeds. There's a lot of really, really excellent material out there, that some of which I pulled from to even say anything about those folks tonight. So we will focus mostly on the real reason why we do this. So our ancestral lineage that we do here at Brightway Zen, there are two different versions. There's a service A and there's a service B. Service A is the actual teacher to student transmission lineage, Dharma transmission lineage, where the teacher had a student who was very committed, had ordained, been practicing for many years, and they said, "You know what? You have attained the level of Dharma that I have, or maybe you've exceeded it in some cases. And so I'm going to give you Dharma transmission," which essentially means the Dharma is safe with you. My Dharma is safe with you. I'm giving you Dharma transmission, and it's got some, practical sides to it, but really it was a matter of saying, okay, we can keep passing this down to the next generation, and so on and so on and so on. And it goes for, thousands of years. It's actually kind of a remarkable thing that we have a list of ancestors, teacher to student transmission. So that's service A. The downside of that particular lineage is that it is almost entirely male in gender. One and a half of the ancestors on that list are not male. We're of course, including our own Dharma great grandmother, Jiyu Kennett, who founded the whole lineage that we're in. And I'll talk about her a little bit more later. And then there's kind of a half a mention for Hanyatara, who was Bodhidharma's teacher, who originally was considered to be male, but a lot of scholarly sources, and even Ehe Dogen himself considered Hanyatara to be a female teacher. So, well, yeah, I think we're going to call her female because I think that's a better version of the story. So, service B, then, that we do on alternating Sundays. And for those of you who have not practiced with us at those times, we do this lineage chant on Sunday mornings that we do at 9:30 Pacific time. And we also do it during our Sesshin and Zazenkai retreats. So if you've participated in any of those, you've already done the lineage chants. Service B is a list of female ancestors to try to compensate for the fact that the transmission lineage is so predominantly male. We need to give some respect and attention to the female teachers who have had such a major impact and worked a whole hell of a lot harder to get to where they were in the Dharma than any of the men did. So it's a really important thing for us to honor the female ancestors. The female lineage that we chant is not an actual Dharma transmission lineage. It's not sequential. It's not even specific to Zen. I mean, some of the male ancestry isn't specific to Zen either. There's a point at which it becomes Zen, but prior to that is other Mahayana and even pre-Mahayana traditions. So it's a little more of a mixed bag.
So you're saying the second list is all female?
Yeah. Service B is all female teachers. So we're going to talk about a few of them. I'm going to try to say a few words about figures in the male lineage and also figures in the female lineage today. But again, I don't want to do a whole lot of biographical background because there are excellent resources out there for that type of information if you're curious. So, in keeping with the pattern that we've established in this study series, I would like to actually chant the lineage. So, you've got chant books here. Mark, if you've got the link there for the folks in the cloud, The we're going to go ahead and do the ancestral lineage because it is the teacher to student Dharma transmission lineage, and male, female, alien, it wouldn't really matter. These are the people who handed the Dharma down to the successive generations and kept it down, going all the way from Shakyamuni to us. So it's extraordinarily important for our lineage. Again, not because it's male, but because it's Dharma transmission. So we're going to chant this, and what I'm going to do, we don't usually take it out of context like we are tonight, so it's going to be a little interesting. And that's why the sound might be a little weird, because I'm actually going to be whacking the thing here, the bell. So I'm going to start with the little recitation that is immediately preceding the ancestral lineage. And then I will begin the lineage. Page seven, sorry.
I didn't hear it said.
Yeah, my apologies. Printed page 7, so what's that, page 10 or 9 of the PDF if you're looking at it that way. Okay, here we go. Throughout space and time, human beings have penetrated and actualized this practice. They have passed the teaching down through the generations from teacher to student, face to face. In gratitude, we offer the merit of our recitation of the harmony of difference and sameness to the 7 ancient Buddhas and to the teachers in our lineage in India, China, Japan, and America. Bibashi Buddha, great teacher. Shiki Buddha, great teacher. Bishapu Buddha, great teacher. Korosong Buddha, great teacher. Kunakon Muni Buddha, great teacher. Kasho Buddha, great teacher. Shakyamuni Buddha, great teacher. Great teacher, Makakasho, great teacher. Ananda, great teacher. Shonawashu, great teacher. Ubakikuta, great teacher. Daitaka, great teacher. Mishaka, great teacher. Bashumita, great teacher. Butsudanandai, great teacher. Budamita, great teacher. Parishiba, great teacher. Punayasha, great teacher. Anabote, great teacher. Kahimora, great teacher. Nagyarajuna, great teacher. Kanataiba, great teacher. Raghurata, great teacher. Sogyanandai, great teacher. Kayashata, great teacher. Kumorata, great teacher. Shayata, great teacher. Pashupanzu, great teacher. Manura, great teacher. Kakurokuna, great teacher. Shishibodai, great teacher. Pashashita, great teacher. Kunyomita, great teacher. Anyatara, great teacher. Bodai Daruma, great teacher. Taiso Eka, great teacher. Tanchi Sosan, great teacher. Daiyi Doshin, great teacher. Daiman Konin, great teacher. Daikan Eno, great teacher. Segen Yoshi, great teacher. Sekito Kisen, great teacher. Yakusan Igen, great teacher. Unbon Donjo, great teacher. Tozan Rokai, great teacher. Unbo Doyo, great teacher. Doan Dohi, great teacher. Doan Kanchi, great teacher. Yozan Enkan, great teacher. Taiyo Kyogen, great teacher. Tosu Gise, great teacher. Fuyo Dokai, great teacher. Tanka Shijun, great teacher. Choro Serio, great teacher. Tendo Sokaku, great teacher. Secho Chikan, great teacher. Tendo Nyojo, great teacher. Ehe Dogen, great teacher. Koun Ejo, great teacher. Tetsu Kikai, great teacher. Keizan Jokin, great teacher. Meho Sotetsu, great teacher. Shugan Doshin, great teacher. Tetsuzan Shikaku, great teacher.
Ganesho, great teacher. Chusanryo Hun, great teacher. Kisan Tonin, great teacher. Shogaku Kenri, great teacher. Kinen Horyu, great teacher. Teishitsu Chisen, great teacher. Koke Shojun, great teacher. Sesso Yuho, great teacher. Taiten Genju, great teacher. Shuzan Shuncho, great teacher. Chosan Senyetsu, great teacher. Fukushu Kochi, great teacher. Medo Yutong, great teacher. Hakuho Genteki, great teacher. Keshu Soko, great teacher. Manzan Dohaku, great teacher. Giko, great teacher. Daiyu Esho, great teacher. Gegon Sokai, great teacher. Shogun Taizui, great teacher. Nichirin Togo, great teacher. Sonno Kyodo, great teacher. Sogaku Reiro, great teacher. Daishu Benki, great teacher. Koho Hakugan, great teacher. Keiro Chisan, great teacher.
So those of you who are used to chanting this, that was quite a bit faster than we usually do it. For sake of time, I wanted to kind of rock and roll through that. So for those of you in the cloud, just in case you're wondering, I know you never get to see this because the Fukudo, the chant leader, sits way back in the corner over here out of camera range. But what I was doing was taking this big hammered kesu bell, and I've got my beater, and I'm resting it on the side, and then I'm giving it a little... just a little bump, like so. Sometimes I hit it a little more forcefully than others. I apologize for that.
James,
all right, yes.
Do you want to talk about the meaning of that, how some teachers have the triangle?
Well, that's what I'm going to get to. Thank you. Wow, foreshadowing. I love it. All right, I'm going to flip the original sound off. So now that, yeah, okay. I've turned the original sound off now, so we'll be back to speaking mode. So thank you for putting up with the audio quality in the cloud for the meantime while we got through all that. So yes, why do we chant those names? Before we get to that though, obviously, as you can see there, we trace our lineage all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha of our age, and literally every tradition of Buddhism traces their lineage back to Shakyamuni Buddha. I will say, just as a sidebar, the idea of tracing lineage, master to student, Dharma transmission, all that type of thing, is really kind of specific to Zen. You don't really find it in many other traditions of Buddhism. They might have a list of ancestors, but they don't put it to the forefront of their daily practice exactly the way that we do in Zen. So, of course, Shakyamuni Buddha and some of the names that we chanted that were a little beyond for at least the first couple hundred years after Shakyamuni Buddha would be fairly... universal to any tradition of Buddhism. But then obviously it starts to branch pretty quickly. We see some of the names there that when they start to get into the Chinese and the Japanese names in particular, for instance, we chanted Eihei Dogen. We talk about Eihei Dogen all the time as the founder of Soto Zen in Japan specifically, right? So he brought Soto Zen to Japan, and that's the style that we practice here. Most all of the Zen lineages that we are familiar with in the West descended from Keizan Jokin as well, so the other name. If you want to have the chant book and kind of look at these names, that's fine. It might be helpful for reference to see where they are. So for instance, if you start from Keizan and go many, many, many hundred years into the future, you land on people like Shunryu Suzuki. And he's got a vast number of disciples, including people that we're familiar with in our study, such as Norman Zoketsu Fisher, Taigen Dan Layton, Shojin Mel Weitzman, Shinshu Roberts from Ocean Gate Zen Center, and Alan Hozan Sanake. Another descendant of Keizan Jokin, a couple hundred years later, of course, would be Taizen Maizumi Roshi, who was the teacher who gave Dharma transmission to other names that we're familiar with, such as Joan Halifax Roshi down in New Mexico, our own Chosen and Hogan Bays up here in Klatskanai, Daido Lori, John Daido Lori, Enkyo O'Hara, and Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi. Some other well-known teachers from today also trace back to a later common ancestor, Geshu Soko, which you'll see, I think, on the last column of the second page of the chant. Geshu Soko had two, he's 17th century, he had two primary disciples, Tokuo Ryoko, and from Ryoko's lineage, we get Shohaku Okamura, Dainen Katagiri Roshi, among others. And then his other main disciple was Manzan Dohaku, who we just chanted, whose lineage descends down to our own Jiu Kennet, and a name that we chant in our dedication of merit, Dayan Banach, is also under Manzan Dohaku's lineage. So there's a really excellent, I'm not sure exactly where it is right now online, but there's a really beautiful Soto Zen lineage chart that traces all of that specific chain, starting at least from Keizan, if not going back to Ehedogen. And you can see all the ways that it branches and gets down to some names that you may recognize as well. So our particular lineage that we're practicing here at Right Way Zen is in what we call the Dharma Cloud lineage, and that's descended from Roshi Jiu Kennet, Koen Jiu Kennet. So she was given Dharma transmission from Keiro Chisan, whom we chanted. And you can keep going back. So Jiu Kennet gave Dharma transmission to Hoan Kyogen Carlson and Gyokuko Carlson, who then went on to found Dharma Rain Zen Center right here in Portland. And Gyokuko Carlson gave Dharma transmission to Domio Burke, who is our teacher here. So you can see the change. So when Gyokuko passes away, hopefully not too soon, her name will be added to this list. And if Domio ever transmits to somebody and then she passes away, not too soon again, then her name would go on that list. And then it would continue and roll on and on and on down. So it's important to look. We are looking at it as a backwards document, but it actually should be somewhat of a living document in that names keep getting added as there's a student or a teacher to student and also student to teacher transmission, where then that teacher passes away and their name gets added to the list. So we'll just see where it ends up. It'll be interesting to see this list in 100 years. So why do we chant this lineage? What's so important about putting this in our chanting service? So much so that we do two different versions of it every single time we do a Sunday service and every time we do Zazen Kai or Sesshin. And I'm going to quote Domyo because she had a really nice way of encapsulating this. And this is actually from the Bright Way Zen website itself on the page that talks about lineage. Quote, "The story of our Zen tradition is full of such pivotal actions and decisions on the part of individuals because ours is a lineage tradition. We keep careful track of the relationship between teacher and student over time. The essence of Zen is something that two human beings recognize together, face to face. Much can be learned and achieved by reading or listening to Dharma, sitting Zazen, keeping the precepts, and taking up many other useful Buddhist practices. But the lifeblood of Zen, what keeps it vital and profound over the centuries as it moves from country to country and culture to culture, is the effort to awaken to our true nature. And how do we know someone has awakened to their true nature? How can we know when they are capable of passing this lifeblood of Zen on to the next generation? Only another awakened being can know. So awakened teacher meets awakened student face to face, generation after generation. In gratitude for the Zen teaching we have received, we celebrate these encounters we call transmission, although no thing is transmitted, and we keep track of our lineage throughout time." End quote. So it's really about connecting with and paying respect to the actual human beings that lived centuries after century after century after century, and many of them just fought tooth and nail to transmit this Dharma to the next generation, to their students. Many of them were operating in situations where they were under extreme duress. They were in periods of wartime. They were in periods of poverty and drought and famine. They were in periods of time where Buddhism was outlawed completely. And they had to continue practicing anyway. the very raka suit that Jim referred to and that Jinryu is wearing and was meant to be a way for Buddhists to keep in touch with the Dharma, keep in touch with their practice, even when Buddhism was outlawed, because that garment could be worn underneath your clothes. It's meant to be the Buddha's robe, but it could be hidden away if necessary. So we're chanting these names hundreds, if not thousands of years after these people are gone, simply because, as the old adage says, no one truly forgets you until the last person has spoken your name. Right? We're still speaking these folks' names week after week in Zen centers around the world. These names are being chanted time and again as a way of honoring and connecting to our ancestry. So why is this specifically Zen? Well, it goes along with the way that Zen is this face-to-face transmission type of situation. It's not just, oh, a bunch of people practicing and, okay, you look pretty good, so let's bring you up to the teacher scene and now you're the boss. It's more of a connection, like literally almost a psychic connection between teacher and student, where the teacher and the student realize simultaneously, you have, in the words of Bodhidharma, you have my flesh, you have my bones, you have my marrow. Right? There's a literal connection there that only the teacher and student can recognize. But it probably helped as Zen proceeded to flourish, especially in China and in Japan. It didn't hurt that those East Asian cultures already had very strong traditions of honoring ancestors. Right? Honoring your ancestry is a very, very big part of culture in China and Japan. And so it's lovely to see how in this cultural context, Japanese people, Chinese people would already go to the ancestors' graves and offer incense and offer flowers and pay respects and do ceremonies and chants and all sorts of things to honor their ancestors. And now here comes Zen adopting the same practices, but putting it in the context of Zen practice. The master is the parent and the student is the child, but the student is also the parent and the master is also the child in a way, right? And one thing that I love about Zen is how in this context, we think of it as family. You're my parent, I'm your child, or vice versa, or whatever, that we are all Dharma siblings. I love how we call each other Dharma sister, Dharma brother. Lovely. I mean, there are many people in this room that I could rely on more than I could my own flesh and blood brothers and sisters. You know, I don't have a sister, but so it's a beautiful thing that we have this Sangha as family. And this parental, this sibling relationship to each other. And it's been going on for thousands of years. So let's talk about a handful of the names on the list. So I'm going to answer Drew's question very specifically. So that little bonk that I did with the bell is called a kwats, which is actually a word for any kind of a loud sound that is common in Zen. In the Rinzai Zen tradition, a kwats is literally the teacher going, what? You know, letting out a big shout, and it's meant to awaken the student, you know, shock them out of their delusion and whatever their mind spinning is doing. And there's many stories in the koan collection of students who awakened at the sound of the quats or getting hit by the kisak. I'll give you 60 blows with my stick. Rinzai is a little more violent than we are. And so it's fine. They've got their thing. I'm being cheeky. That's not entirely true. So the reason why we do the quats, and if you have actually done the chant with us, either in the cloud or in the dirt zendo, you'll notice that not only do we hit the bell on the side, but Domyo, who is sitting on her bowing mat in front of the altar, does this when we do that too. She does a bow, a sitting bow. She doesn't do a full prostration from a standing position, but she's seated and she does a prostration to the Buddha at that moment in time as well. And the reason why we do that is because that particular ancestor had some influence on our practice that carries down today that we can actually tangibly, in many cases, we can actually tangibly see and identify that comes from so-and-so. Like we do it this way because of that person. They codified it 800 years ago or whatever it is. Like, can actually point to us. So it's actually really remarkable. I can never fail to be amazed at how strong the records are and the traditions are and the way that this all gets handed down. So if you want to look at the chant book, I'm going to actually go name by name here, and trying to be mindful of my time. Let's see the clock. I really do need to change my prescription. These classes are not working. So the six mythical Buddhas that start off the list are mythical. There would be no way for us to know if there was a Buddha prior to Shakyamuni Buddha, who was the Buddha that lived in northern India 2,500 years ago. No way for us to know if there was a Buddha before. But that's not important. As I said last week when we were talking about the Sutra opening verse and all the legends around it, it's true whether it happened or not. Right? It's the facts are not as important as the message behind it. So these six mythical Buddhas exist primarily to be somewhat of an archetype for the idea that the Dharma did not start with Shakyamuni Buddha. Siddhartha Gautama, who lived in northern India and was a prince of the Shakya clan, and then the blah, 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 blah. And then awakened and all these students and started this teaching and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, he was not the one that invented this. The Dharma existed before he came along. And in the, if you look at Buddhist cosmology and mythology, it existed for numerous kalpas, which, remember what I said last week, if you were here, the definition of a kalpa is there's a very huge mountain, like the size of Mount Sumeru, you know, and here comes a hawk with a feather every 100 years and just brushes the top of the mountain. And a kalpa is the length of time it would take for the mountain to be eroded away to nothing. What's that? Billions of years? Trillions of years? Is it even, can you even count, right? So that's a kalpa, right? So the idea here is that the Dharma preceded Shakyamuni Buddha. He did not create it. He did not invent it. He awakened to it. It was already there, which is a concept that's really important to what in Zen we call our inherent Buddha nature. We are all awakened beings. We just haven't figured it out yet. You know, that awakening is in there somewhere. I don't know if it's in my back pocket or where it is, but it's there. I just have to discover it, and you just have to discover it, because we are all already Buddha. So that's the reason we chant those six names, to remind us that it wasn't Shakyamuni, he wasn't the first, and he won't be the last either. Right? So then there's Shakyamuni Buddha himself, the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, all that, blah, blah, blah. But I'm not going to talk about him, because we probably talk about that guy a lot, and there's lots of really good information out there. I'd like to keep going. I want to spend a little bit more time on names that maybe you're not as familiar with. The next ancestor, I might actually end up skipping somebody for sake of time, but the next ancestor on the list is Nagarjuna, as we chant, or Nagarjuna. He is considered the 14th ancestor of Buddhism in general. He is not specific to Zen, but he is an early Mahayanist. He was one of the early teachers in the Mahayana, the so-called Great Vehicle. So again, if you were here last week, we talked about the whole Hinayana versus Mahayana. So he was one of the early developers of and proponents of the Mahayana ideal and everything that came along with it. So an interesting thing about Nagarjuna, well, actually, from a factual perspective, the most important thing that Nagarjuna did was propagate Mahayana ideals through a text called the Mula Madhyama Kakarika. Say that five times fast, which translates from the Sanskrit as Discourses on the Middle Way. And there's actually a really lovely book by Stephen Batchelor, I don't know if we have it in the library or not, called Verses from the Center, where he translates the Mula Madhyama Kakarika. But his commentary is amazing and wonderful. I love it. So you should check that book out if you're interested in the Discourses on the Middle Way. So this fun thing about Nagarjuna. Mark, did you just hold it up? Of course you would. You would just have it right there. Of course. There we go. There's Mark, ladies and gentlemen. So legend has his name, Nagarjuna, means champion of the Nagas, Nagarjuna. And legend has it that Nagarjuna traveled to this mythical lake and went to the bottom of this mythical lake where the Naga realm was, the sea serpents, that supposedly the Buddha had recorded all these advanced teachings that his followers were never going to get, and said to the Naga king, here, take these and hide them away until humanity's ready for this. Because my guys are not yet ready. And so apparently Nagarjuna was the one that actually went and said, okay, great. Hey, here are these new Mahayana teachings. And it was technically, it's the Prajnaparamita Sutras, all of the, which includes the Harp Sutra as one. And then there's a whole there's a whole story about, you know, was it Zhuo Zheng, you know, picking him up from some old sick man and then bringing them to China. There's this really amazing history behind all that. Anyway, moving on. Like I said, I'm not going to like provide a whole bunch of really crazy stories about all these folks for sake of time. Bodhi Dharma, which is the Japanese rendering of the name, Sanskrit word Bodhidharma, whom we know, we say his name a lot. So Bodhidharma is one of the things that is really important about him, probably the main thing that's really important about him was his way of conveying the Dharma. So legend has it that when he first traveled to China, he was the red-haired barbarian from the West, red-bearded barbarian from the West, which the West in that case was India, and he came to China, right? And apparently, emissaries in India sent word ahead, Bodhidharma is coming. He's this Buddhist master. You got to check him out. So the Chinese knew he was coming. So he gets to China, and there's all these people waiting for him, like, oh, expound the Dharma for us. And he sat Zazen, and he stood up, and he walked away without saying a word. I love Bodhidharma because he's just so punk rock. He's like, yeah, screw you guys, man. No, you're not getting any Dharma talk, man. That's a disrespectful way to put it. But he sent Zazen and got up and walked away. And Emperor Wu, hearing the story, is like, who in the world is this cat? Because that is not how we do things. So he goes before Emperor Wu. And then, of course, the whole famous story about, you know, hey, Bodhidharma, what do you think about all the merit I've accumulated by building all these Buddhist temples? And Bodhidharma was like, eh, nah, you know, and then, you know, flapped out his sleeves and walked off. And the emperor was like, what just happened here? So then he went and faced the wall for 9 years in a cave. And we all know those stories. So it's the idea that his method of teaching was just so much centered around Zazen and so much around this idea that you couldn't really put it into words. And if you put it into words, it was kind of already gone, right? And so he had this really new way of teaching that wasn't really done then. I mean, back then it was like, oh, you got to study these sutras, you got to master the sutras, you got to be able to expound the sutras. And here's this guy who was like, yeah, I don't have time for any of that. Sit Zazen. Just sit and wake up, sit and wake up, sit and wake up. So that was very, very new thinking. So he's considered the founder of Zen, but Zen as we know it historically didn't really get cranking for about another 200 years after his passing. So moving down the list to Daikan Eno, the Japanese rendering of Huineng, who is considered the sixth and final patriarch of Zen. The story of Huineng is very popular. It's very well known. It's recorded in the Platform Sutra, which is apparently a sutra that he expounded from a platform, a teaching platform. So I'm not going to get into all the details of that. It's a very interesting story. And it's largely all fictionalized, more than likely, by a later monk who wanted to promote Huineng's Dharma over a competing school. And so he made up all this fantastical stuff that some of it may or may not be true. But again, it's true whether it happened or not. It's not about the facts of the story. So whether Huineng ever, you know, so the story goes that he was an illiterate woodcutter, taking care of mom, dad was gone, and he awakened at the sound, single line out of the Diamond Sutra and said, I got to know where to study that. Took off to Hongren's monastery. Hongren immediately recognized him. You're a little different. You know? So not only was he illiterate, so he couldn't read the sutras, and he was a woodcutter. So it wasn't like, you know, like in those days, like you had to be at a certain caste. You had to be a certain class of person to like enter the monastery and study. And he's just a woodcutter, right? And then, so Hongren's like, you got something, buddy, but I'm sticking you in the back and pounding rice in the mill because the community is not going to accept you. He didn't even ordain him. So he couldn't read the sutras. He didn't ordain. And then he ends up, because of the whole poem written on the wall about the mirror and the dust and all that. I'm assuming a lot of knowledge on your part right now. But so if you're like, what is he talking about? Come to me and I'll give you some resources. You go back and study him here. But the important thing is that Hongren transmitted the Dharma to him. He was not ordained and he hadn't even read a sutra. He had heard the Diamond Sutra spoken to him. So the reason why Huineng, whether the story is true or not, the reason why he's so important is because, and he was really the propagator of this idea that transmission is a tradition outside the scriptures. It doesn't require having memorized the Diamond Sutra or anything and being able to expound eloquently on these. You just have to know in your own true innate nature, which even a southern jungle rat, which was the epithet that they used for him in the monastery, because he was from the south and he was illiterate. He was just like a barbarian as far as they were concerned. It was very uncouth, you know. The fact that he could awaken and be transmitted the Dharma over some monastic that had been practicing for decades, that was a big deal. And so what it points out is the way in which Buddha nature is accessible to every single one of us, regardless of class, regardless of race, regardless of gender, regardless of you know, intelligence or lack thereof, as one of the texts says. So it's a very important message that we get from Huineng, that the Dharma is for everybody and everybody can awaken, because everybody has Buddha nature, even a southern jungle rat. Okay, another name, moving further down. Tozan Ryokai. He was 9th century Zen master. We refer to him more commonly by his Chinese name, Dongshang Ningjie. So Dongshan is the, we just usually use the name of his mountain. Probably the major contribution that Dongshan has to our lineage is that his Japanese name Tozan, the Japanese version of his name Tozan, is the To in So To. So So To Zen. The To comes from him, and the So comes from his student Sozan. So between Tozan and Sozan, we get Soto Zen. Soto Zen. Which I was cracking up because I'm studying Japanese. And Soto is an actual Japanese word, which means outside. I was like, oh. I mean, they have nothing to do with each other, but I was like, yeah, man, we're outside. Anyway, so Tozan's other major contribution to our tradition is the composition of the Precious Mirror Samadhi, which we also chant in our chanting service, and his development of the five ranks system of, you know, the stages of awakening, so to speak, which we don't really focus on a whole lot in Soto Zen, but it's actually extremely important in Rinzai Zen. Let's see, skipping ahead, we're going to skip Dogen. Talk about Dogen all the time. And didn't talk about him anymore. Keizan Jokim. I would like to talk about Keizan Jokim because he is extremely important to our lineage and to a lot of Soto Zen in general. Primarily because he formalized and codified a lot of the practices that we use, a lot of kind of the liturgy that we use today. Keizan was responsible for that. But I think more importantly than that, even, he was responsible for taking Soto Zen and saying, this just does not need to just be a monastic thing. We shouldn't be like cloistering ourselves away in these monasteries that are up on mountains, and, you know, all the people down in the village down below have to come up to see, you know, whatever we do. And we have festivals a couple times a year and they got to come up for that. He was really instrumental in bringing Zen temples into rural areas, creating a format where the Zen temple was much more conducive to lay practice and to these just rural villagers being able to come into the temple and practice. And there are still temples exactly like this in existence today, that in this Keizan model. I went into one, we went into one, Xander with me. We went into one in on Kauai, the island of Kauai, because a lot of the Japanese Soto Zen temples, they actually look a lot more like a church. They're not like this at all. They don't have cushions. They don't sit zazen in a, you know, a zazen posture like we do. We're practicing a monastic form here, actually. But in Japan and in some of these Zen temples, it's a lot more like church. You got pews and you got a book and you chant and all that. So Keizan is responsible for that style. And a really kind of a timely one, he was the main proponent of the Zaike Tokudo style work. These lay practitioners are not really all that different from these monks that are sitting there with their bald heads in the monastery. They can awaken too. And so he wanted a format, or he wanted a system where they could take a lay ordination and become an integral part and even get Dharma transmission, lay transmission. So this was really important to Keizan as well. So He's extremely important for really, I think, kind of establishing a lot of the basic things that we kind of take for granted in this tradition is just being how we do things. And we have Keizan to thank for a lot of that. I'm going to move down to Manzando Haku. This one's kind of more systemic than anything else, but his primary contribution to Soto Zen in general was that prior to Manzando Haku, and I'm not sure when this started, let's say you're the senior practitioner or even the abbot of a monastery, right? And now you get asked, hey, can you go become the abbot of this other monastery? Well, in those days, before Manzando Haku, when you moved to the other temple, you had to abandon the transmission lineage that you had gotten from your teacher, whatever your lineage was, whatever your you were transmitted in, and you had to adopt the lineage of the temple that you were taking over, which caused, you can imagine, caused a huge problem, because now you're like, I don't know anything about this lineage, but here I am, the abbot of this temple, and now students are coming to me, and I don't know what to tell them. You know, so it was really kind of rough. And then it was like nobody knew who's what lineage are you? I don't know. I moved around to three different temples. I've had three different lineages. It was all a big kerfuffle. So Manzan basically he had to work really hard to get the powers that be to accept this. We need to go back to student to teacher transmission, and it moves with you wherever you go. You go be the abbot of seven different temples, doesn't matter. You're still in the lineage that you were transmitted in, and you take that with you. And so we have Manzan to thank for that that practice. Moving on down to, and I probably skipped, I can't remember, but Keido Chisan. Keido Chisan is very important to our lineage for two primary reasons. First and foremost, he was the abbot at Soji-ji. In the early part of the 20th century. And he had a really sincere wish that Soto Zen be transmitted to the West. A lot of other Japanese priests were just like, whatever, let them be what they want to be. I don't care. But he really wanted to see Soto Zen flourish in the West. There had already been Soto Zen teachers coming to the West, and D.T. Suzuki and some of the others that came earlier, but hadn't really established a foothold. And Keido Chisan really wanted to see it thrive and survive. And he was an extremely passionate advocate for women being ordained and having all the same status as any male teacher. And so when he was on a teaching tour and he was in England and he met Peggy Kennett, and Peggy Kennett was already practicing Theravada Buddhism, and she came to his talk, and they talked and whatever, and he said, hey, why don't you come practice with me in Soji-ji in Japan? And she said, sure, I'll be there in 2 years. I don't know, she didn't say that, but it took about a couple of years, I think. She went to Singapore, and she went to Korea. She was ordained and got the Dharma Name Jiu, and then she finally ended up at Soji-ji. So she was the first woman and the first Westerner to train at Soji-ji, which is, and was then, one of the two head temples of the Soto Zen. So it wasn't just some out-of-the-way temple where nobody was going to see her. It was the spot, man. It was Grand Central for Soto Zen in Japan. And here's this white woman practicing there. So amazing, amazing accomplishment for, you know, an amazing vision on his part and amazing accomplishment on her part to go into the lion's den, so to speak, and face that, what must have been an extraordinarily daunting atmosphere and environment. So let's talk about Jiu Kennett, the final name on our list, for the Dharma transmission list at least. As I said, she trained at Soji-ji with Keido Chisan. He wasn't her primary teacher because he was the abbot. He was like super busy with a lot of other things, but he gave her Dharma transmission nonetheless. And then she ended up accomplishing a couple of other things there at Soji-ji. She then was made the abbess of her own temple for a while. But then 1967, Keido Chisan died. And upon the death of Keido Chisan, the Soto Shu basically said, well, your protector is no longer around. So, but what they did do, even though they kind of dismissed her, they did say, you know what? We would like you to establish a monastery, an official Soto Shu Zen monastery in the West. What do you think? And she probably saw the writing on the wall and was like, yeah, we get out of here and go over there. So she came to California and bounced around San Francisco, a couple different places, but then eventually went to Shasta and founded Shasta Abbey. So Shasta Abbey is the very first Zen monastery in the United States founded by a woman. Pretty cool. So Geo Kennett is actually awesome because she gets to be on both lists. The Dharma transmission list, which is predominantly male, and the female teacher list. So let's talk about the female lineage with what little bit of time I have left. Oh boy, running out of time. So I can't remember what page this starts on if you wanted to look at the names. There's only a couple. What's it?
19.
Thank you. 19 on the physical chant book. Let's see, I want to make sure to be strategic about who I talk about here. Let me sidebar. A lot of the information that I've got for this next segment, I got from Sally Jiko Tisdale's wonderful book, Women of the Way. Fabulous book. And I was so glad to see her at the Buddhist Festival and be able to tell her, thank you. That book was so great to save me by life. Not only is it a wonderful history on what history there is of these female Zen practitioners, but the way that she writes is just, it's so engrossing. It's like, it reads like a novel almost. It's really cool. So definitely pick that book up. So Mahapajapati is one of the first name on the list against the Quats. Considered to be the first nun ever, the first Buddhist nun ever. She was the Buddha's stepmother, adopted foster mother, whatever you want to call her, because his birth mother passed away a few days after he was born. And she was there in the court and became his mother. So after he started teaching and had been traveling around and whatnot, she was actually always, from like day one, she was seeing that Siddhartha was like discontented with the palace life. And so when he took off to go ordain to become an ascetic prior to his awakening, she was like, yeah, I kind of saw that one coming. So she was kind of always in the Siddhartha as an ascetic, Siddhartha as a holy man camp. She was always like thumbs up on that, even when others weren't. So when he became a teacher, she went to his attendant, the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, and said, you got to ask him to let us ordain. He's got to ordain women. Got to do it. And the Buddha was like, no. For a while, he put it off. And I think it was probably less sexism because he's a fully awakened being. How can he be sexist? Like, would it be possible? You know, but it was more about the cultural politics of the day. Like, he was a realist, right? He couldn't take, I'm taking all these men who want to ordain and be a part of my Sangha. You know, now these communities are, you know, they've got half the number of men that they have because all these guys came. And now I'm going to take the women too. Like, that was kind of the mindset that a lot of people think he had. And so he put it off and put it off and put it off. And then finally he did consent, and 500 women, including Mahapajapati, became a part of his Sangha. So there's more to that story, of course, and not all of it is good, but we don't have time for all that. I'm going to skip forward. I already mentioned Hanyatara, but as an honorable mention, she's not on the female ancestor list. I want to skip ahead to Dzungchur, D-Z-U-N-G-C-H-R, Dzungchur, which in Japanese is pronounced Dzongchi. So Dzongchi is an interesting figure because she was a daughter of Emperor Wu, who was like a little toddler during the whole interaction between Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma. She was apparently present at somewhere in the palace when that whole exchange happened. And so as she grew up, she became, and there's a lot of stories like this in the history of Zen Buddhism, like rich person, aristocrat, becomes disillusioned with the life of wealth. And I'm going to talk about this in a couple of weeks when I do my Sangha Voices talk about, you know, starting from a place of privilege and then realizing this is not all it's cracked up to be, which the Buddha himself did. And she did it too. And so she left the palace and ordained, and she went and found Bodhidharma and became one of his four primary disciples. And they wandered around and did all their stuff that they did. And then at the end of his life, when Bodhidharma asked his students to, okay, show me what you got. What have you learned that I've taught you? And he went down the row, and the first monk said, you know, gave him teaching. He said, you have my skin. And then he went to the next monastic, which was Dzongchi, and she gave him her understanding, and he said to her, "You have my flesh." And then he went down to the next one, "You have my bone." And then Huike, his primary disciple, was the last, and he was the one who, "You are my marrow." So he was the most realized of the bunch, but she was the third most realized of that particular group. And then so Huike became the ancestor in the lineage because you get the Dharma transmission, but she was an extremely important figure for having this flash, at least, you know, having enough realization to be considered a very realized person. Let's see, move down. I'm going to pass Moshan Liaoran, but go to Zenshin. Zenshin is an interesting name because she became the first in the year 590. They actually have records of this. In the 590 of the Common Era, she became the first Japanese person to become fully ordained. Oh, that's crazy. Right. Yeah. A woman in a Korean tradition. Yeah. In a Korean tradition. She was the first one. So she ended up founding a nunnery in Japan called Tayuradera, which actually still stands in Asuka, which is just to the southeast of Osaka. You can actually visit it today. It's kind of between Osaka and the Kii Peninsula. So kind of cool. Running out of time. Okay. Let me get to the... So I just blew through so many names, but again, there's a lot of really good information out there if you're curious about any of these. The point that I wanted to make with each of the very few people that I actually had time to talk about was the reason why they get the little quats, the reason why they get the hit on the belt is because they did something important or influential that still carries with us in our practice today. But all of the names on the list are obviously important because without even one of those names, the Dharma would not have been transmitted to the next generation and that lineage would have died out. Who knows where we would be without even one of the people on that name. So it's fantastic. It's this list of these greatly realized people, you know, teacher to student transmission. But they were just people. They were just people just like you and I. There's a famous story going back to Huineng, the sixth patriarch. There's a famous story about how when he got the robe and bowl, and then Hongren said, "You better get out of here because the monks are going to be completely hacked off." And he ran away, and the monks actually started chasing him. "We're going to get that robe and bowl back, man. He doesn't deserve it." And there was one person in particular. What's his name? Weiming. It was like this big brute of a guy, had been a general in the military. He was like, "I'm going to get that guy here." And he finally caught up to Huineng on a mountain. And Huineng put the robe and bowl down on a rock and said, "Okay, take it." And Huineng said, "I did not come for the robe and bowl. I came for the Dharma." And that is the most essential element of every single person on this list. They didn't come for titles. They didn't come to be the big boss of their own monastery and get all the accolades and all the money and all that. They came for the Dharma. They came for awakening. And this is the archetype for everybody who practices the Great Way. Doesn't matter who you are. You're Bodhidharma, Keizan Jokin, Mahapajapati, whoever you are, you come for the Dharma. And or us, right? Doesn't matter who you are. Zen master or Zen practitioner. We come for the Dharma and not the robe and bowl. We come to awaken to our own Buddha nature. We come to find an antidote to our suffering and the suffering of others. We all come to realize the truth of emptiness. We don't come for anything but the Dharma. Doesn't matter who you are in that list. All those names just came with the Dharma, just like you and me. And so the transmission continues on a certain level, even with each of us. Okay. All right. I'm really sorry that I went right up to time. Yes, please.
Fortunately, we do have another talk and Sangha Voices that will address the women, I believe. Yes. Spend an hour on the women like we spend an hour on the men.
Yes.
But seriously, you know, we can have a personal relationship with the forms that we have. one of them being the recitation of the names of ancestors. And I, like many people, came to Brightway Zen with parent issues, mother issues, daddy issues, the whole bit. And my parents, by the time I got here, were no longer living. But the weekly recitation of names, seeing it done in other places, going to Rohatsu at Great Vow, this continued recitation of names of people that I've never heard of, but people that we nonetheless revere for one reason or another, it made me very comfortable with my own ancestors, up to and including my parents. So the history is wonderful, and thank you for that. But this is another form that can have meaning for, I mean, talk about finding the Dharma. This is another form that can have meaning for some of us. If it's there, you'll find it.
Thank you, Junior. We appreciate that very much. Unless anybody's really itching to say something. Yeah, okay. Let's do this. Come on. Move on. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas of space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you.